Good morning. Welcome to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. We're glad you're here with us today. Our first case of the day is United States versus Cornelius Green, number 23-2476. And we'll hear from the appellant first.
May it please the court. Jason Ullman on behalf of Mr. Cornelius Green. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
That'll be granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Green's defense in this kidnapping case is that no kidnapping occurred. His co-defendant Murphy, his defense was that a kidnapping did occur, Green did it, and for all intents and purposes, I was kidnapped too. I do not understand how a jury could reasonably construct a sequence of events that accommodates the essence of both of those defenses, and that's the heart of the problem at this case. I'll step back and talk about the analysis that the court takes in this circumstance. It's a two-part test. The first is, was there an abuse of discretion? And that analysis looks at the state of the record at the time.
We decided the Voight case, and it seems like that's sort of all we haven't talked about this too much, have we, in our published opinions?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think the most recent and most compelling discussion was in U.S. versus Blunt and Hall, the co-defendant case where a husband and wife were tried together. That's correct. The state of the record at the time that the motion was made is what dictates the abuse of discretion analysis.
Yes.
Taking into
account. And at that time, at the last, your client made a number of motions to sever.
Correct.
But at the last one, it was, as I remember, it was after Murphy's counsel stipulated that Murphy was not going to testify that Green in any way influenced him, that it was Wong who was Wong was the one that was controlling whatever this episode was. Isn't that accurate? Wasn't that the last motion to sever?
That's an accurate statement of the record, Your Honor, but I believe that that was an abuse of discretion and that three separate abuses of discretion occurred in that ruling.
How do you say that? If the district court, and you accurately said it's a question of what the district court had in front of it.
As well as what trial developments were reasonably foreseeable at that point in time.
Okay.
Correct.
Explain that part, how that factors into the equation.
Yes. So at that point in time, and remember, there are two other abuses of discretion that I do want to get back to at that point in time. But at that point in time, what the district court judge knows is that he's already heard the opening statement. Think about what Murphy's counsel says in the opening statement. The child locks are on. Snowell and Will are in the back seat. Then they get out at gunpoint. That is in the opening statement. And then we move through as the trial progresses. The district court judge hears the testimony of Snowell. Snowell says there's three people in the car. One of them has the gun. That's Green. The only time Green doesn't have the gun is when he sets it down to go inside into the Wawa. So we know that Green has the gun. There's only three people. The child locks are on. They're both in the back seat. And additionally, Wong is on the phone directing Green. That's from Snowell's testimony. Wong is on the phone directing Green every step he takes. So I think that this hypergranular focus about did any threats or any coercion come from Green, that totally misses the context of the factual scenario here where Green has the gun and Murphy is saying he's there against his will too. And I think that that prediction is proven correct by Murphy's testimony in the actual case
so
where he does.
Your position is that they're not irreconcilable because of who was the coercer, but just the fact that one person is saying there was no crime and the other person is saying, essentially corroborating part of Snowell's testimony that there was in fact a kidnapping.
That is correct. That's an independent basis of why it is irreconcilable, is that Green says there was no crime, correct, Your Honor. And Murphy says there was a crime, Green did it, and I was one of the victims.
Are those defenses mutually antagonistic?
By the test that Voight articulates, yes. Can a jury reasonably construct a sequence of events that accommodates the essence of both of those defenses? Green says no crime, Murphy says was a crime, and Green did it, and I was a victim too. And the government even concedes in its rebuttal closing argument that Green says no crime, Murphy says there was a crime, but I was justified. Obviously, both of those theories cannot exist. That's what the government said in its rebuttal closing. So I don't think that it's, I don't I think it's pretty clear. I think it's an abuse of discretion that the district court judge knew these two separate defenses were out there. That happens at the close of the government's case in the ruling on the severance. And I think that's the clearest abuse of discretion here.
But the judge, I think, thought that it could be done, that it perhaps wasn't antagonistic, that they were just two defenses. Is it possible that the jury could have accepted both, perhaps, and then, I guess, acquit both?
I think that's impossible for the jury to accept both of them. I have not heard the government. The district court judge did not articulate what series of events would lead to that conclusion of accepting both. The government has not articulated a series of events, and the government in rebuttal closing in the trial itself, the trial lawyer for the government who was closest to the facts and knew the case the best said, I don't understand how these theories, obviously both of these theories cannot be true.
Judicial economy is one of the factors that district courts are to weigh and we're to weigh. Is our test antiquated?
I don't think that the test is antiquated, particularly because this court reapplied the test as recently as 2019 in U.S. versus Blunt and Hall.
I guess I don't mean antiquated so much as in a calendar basis, but if you look at statistics, if you look at, as I remember it over a number of years, one of the motivating factors in looking at judicial economy was the impact on the courts, how the courts operated. You know, at this stage, 2022 statistics show that only 2.3% of federal defendants went to trial in the federal courts. The number of trials that are going on are fewer, far between. Would you argue that perhaps it's time for us to reassess our precedent as to how a district court looks at these motions?
Perhaps, Your Honor, because I don't think it would have been taxing on the court to hold a separate trial, especially when it's clear that Murphy is saying that he was a kidnapping victim too in this particular incident. And indeed, the court did hold a separate trial for the severed out defendant, Wong. And I think that—
So the best way to get a separate trial would be to get a new attorney, right?
It was very effective for Mr. Wong. Unfortunately for Mr. Green. And what happens at Mr. Wong's separate trial is very telling. I mean, Mr. Murphy's testimony is less damning of Green out at Wong's separate trial. He admits that someone offered him help at the Wawa, so he did have an opportunity to escape. So that is affirmative proof, evidence that supports Green's theory that there was no kidnapping. There was no unlawful taking and carrying away because they weren't unlawfully held. They could have left. And Murphy had the opportunity at the Wawa. Okay.
One point that I know you didn't raise, nor did the other side, but our primary cases, Voigt, Safaro, Boschia, that we look at here, were all conspiracy cases. And there's certainly when you have a conspiracy case, there's some additional factors to look at in making a determination on a severance. But this case was not a conspiracy case, was it?
Correct, Your Honor. It is one discrete incident of kidnapping on July 22nd. Correct.
Is there any argument that perhaps you would make that the absence of conspiracy charges would enable us to distinguish this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What would that be?
So that is one, as Your Honor indicated, the precedent that the government relied on and that the district court relied on, it involves conspiracy charges because this was one discrete incident. That precedent is inapplicable. And as we know, in conspiracy cases, the amount of evidence that's relevant and admissible is much broader than in a discrete incident. So evidence of co-defendants, other bad acts is going to be admissible in a conspiracy charge. But here, where it's just one discrete episode, the scope of evidence that is admissible is much smaller. I agree with Your Honor.
Might I ask you your position on the limiting instruction? Was it inadequate? Why? And can you formulate what would have been an adequate limiting instruction if your position is that it was inadequate?
Well, my first level position, Your Honor, is that I don't think it's possible to formulate a limiting instruction in this circumstance because of the way that the two defenses were antagonistic, that Green says didn't happen. Murphy says it did. Green did it. And I was a victim too. I think that it would be very, I can't perceive of a limiting instruction that would cure that kind of prejudice here. So I struggle to find words to articulate that would accommodate the defense, that would cure the prejudice in this instance.
We've talked about Voight and Zaffiro, but neither of them were mutually antagonistic cases. What is your best case and the one you would urge that we follow most closely?
U.S. versus Blunt and Hall. That is the most recent precedent. It's the most clear precedent. One of the co-defendants in that case testifies to a duress defense, and is this court correctly held both defendants should have received separate severed trials.
Everything else? Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll get you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thanks. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Sean Camoni for the United States. May it please the court. Your Honors, the standard in this case on appeal is an abuse of discretion. And in order to find an abuse of discretion, this court would have to find that Judge Mariani's decision in denying severance here was arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, that no reasonable person could have made the same decision. As Judge Fisher pointed out, the last motion for severance was raised after the government was ready to rest. And the record before the court at that time did not show any undue prejudice, did not demonstrate that there was a manifestly unjust trial for Cornelius Green.
Can I just ask you, I want to touch on something your adversary brought up. Page 294 of the transcript, the summation. Mr. Green wants you to believe that the kidnapping didn't occur, Mr. Brown. Murphy's counsel wants you to believe that it did occur and he was justified in so doing so. Obviously, both of those theories cannot be true. That's probably right. Isn't that an admission, as your adversary points out, that these defenses are mutually antagonistic?
No, Your Honor. That is an argument on behalf of the government.
Right.
In closing argument, Green's counsel on Appendix 292 did not only argue that no kidnapping occurred, he argued that, well, nobody that's credible has testified about what happened inside Snowell's aunt's house. Maybe it was Murphy who had the gun pointed at Snowell. The only ones who have told you otherwise were two people who are motivated to lie. The defense here was exactly the same defense as the co-defendants in Voight. Murphy said, I did not have the requisite intent because of some other person's actions. In this case, it was Wong.
That the intent is not really the issue. The problem is, even if you don't believe Murphy, that if you conclude he had the intent, you would still conclude there was in fact a kidnapping.
Your Honor, if you credit everything that Murphy said, which Green is asking this court to find that there are mutually antagonistic defenses because Murphy testified in such a way that it prejudiced Green unfairly and that his trial was manifestly unjust. If you credit everything that Murphy said, you can find that the government failed to prove that Cornelius Green intentionally kidnapped Snowell beyond a reasonable doubt. He testified, Murphy at one point testified.
The question isn't whether both could be acquitted under the case law. It seems to me the question is whether both defenses, if one could conclude that Murphy's defense is in fact a good defense, whether you could also conclude that Green's defense. So it's not a question of whether or not you can acquit both. It's a question of both defenses can stand.
And Your Honor, whenever there are multiple defendants in a case who point the finger at each other, there are conflicting defenses. The question is not whether the defenses conflict, but whether there is no scenario where the jury can compartmentalize and give each defendant separate consideration and credit their defenses.
Accept both defenses.
They would not need to, they could accept both defenses in this case because Murphy testified. First, there were facts that Murphy testified to that would support Green's testimony or Green's argument, I should say, that there was no kidnapping. Murphy testified He didn't even know that they were kidnapping Snowell. He thought they were giving him a ride. Wong forced him to drive. Wong put him in the car. But at one point he said Green left the gun in the car when he went into Wawa. How could this be a kidnapping if the person holding the gun isn't even keeping the gun with him, leaves it in the car with the victim under the seat where the victim could access it?
Yeah, but that was his testimony, was it not?
That was Murphy's testimony, Ron.
Murphy's testimony.
Yes.
But didn't the motions to sever precede that?
The motion to sever preceded the testimony, but the right. testimony was consistent with his defense attorney's proffer of what his testimony would be. Murphy at no time said that Green forced him to do anything. He never said he was afraid of Green.
Murphy didn't say that.
Murphy never said that.
He never said that. But when the proffer was made as to what Murphy was going to say, wasn't that antagonistic to what Green was arguing, that there was no kidnapping whatsoever?
No, Your Honor, because what Murphy testified to was that he was forced to drive Snowell to his aunt's house.
Forced.
Forced by Wong. But Murphy...
With Green having the gun.
Murphy or Green was holding the gun,
okay,
which apparently was a gun that Snowell had brought to the clubhouse, and Green was also holding Snowell's cell phone. So the jury could have found that Wong had given Green Snowell's effects if they were driving him home to leave them there. The only thing that was incriminating of Green that Murphy testified about was Green holding the gun on Snowell inside Snowell's aunt's house.
Let me ask another question. What's the harm here? What's the harm here in the district court saying, based on what I've heard, I'm going to grant a severance? What is the harm?
Your Honor, had the district court granted the severance, that also would not have been an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
The harm here is mandating a severance in a case like this, because that would mean that every case with multiple defendants, particularly where at least one testifies, you would be mandated to sever. And I know Your Honor is quoting statistics about the percentage of cases that go to trial, but I can tell you that our district court dockets are clogged. And if we double and triple and quadruple the number of trials, because all multiple defendant trials have to be tried separately, then not only are we going against...
I didn't say that. I don't think anybody's proposing all multi-defendant trials be tried separately, but where there are defenses that... I don't know. It's hard to look at these defenses as they were before the district court and not see some antagonism. And since they come from different defendants, I think you have a pretty classic case of mutual antagonism. We don't have any cases that say what is mutual antagonism. We throw that term out, but we don't have the cases that define what it is.
We do, Your Honor. Voight says that mutually antagonistic defenses are defenses where one defendant...
Yeah, but Voight wasn't mutually antagonistic.
Voight and Zafiro define mutually antagonistic defenses as where one defendant, his claim of innocence, is predicated upon the guilt of the other. That was not what the defense was here from Murphy. Murphy claimed, as in Voight, as this court articulated Voight's co-defendant's defenses, that Murphy's defense was that he lacked criminal intent. And this court said, although it is fairly clear that these defenses, by pointing the finger of blame at Voight, increased the likelihood that Voight would be convicted, the Supreme Court has stated that this type of injury alone does not mandate severance. Zafiro said that mutually antagonistic defenses, even where they exist, are not prejudicial per se and do not require severance. This is not a case where the jury could not compartmentalize. This court has also said that we presume that juries follow the instructions that they were given. In this court's opinion in Riley, this court said that the instructions that were given in this case are persuasive evidence that the defendant was not prejudiced. It is persuasive evidence here as well.
It seems to be a little bit, there seem to be distinguishing features such as typically finger pointing or in a conspiracy, to Judge Fisher's point, there's not a denial that an actual crime occurred. People acknowledge there was a crime. They're simply saying, I wasn't part of the agreement. That's one thing. And here it also seems like Murphy served as a corroborating witness to some extent to Snowell. Do you agree that if they were tried separately and Green were tried first, that Murphy would have been unavailable unless the government cut a deal with him or gave him immunity of some sort?
Your Honor, if Green had been tried first, Murphy may have been unavailable, but that is not the test. And the test is not whether Green would have been more likely to be acquitted in a separate trial. The test is whether there was unfair prejudice. And this court has said that the Supreme Court has said in Zafiro that a defendant is not typically able to exclude competent admissible evidence. So they should not be allowed to exclude that evidence simply because it comes from a co-defendant. Snowell's testimony was corroborated. It was substantially corroborated. There was a video from Wawa that showed Green in the car. There was a photograph on Murphy's phone that would have been admissible without Murphy because it was found under a search warrant.
Can I follow up on that a little bit? You're sort of talking about prejudice. The Seventh Circuit has couched it maybe as also a harmlessness analysis on top of the prejudice. But the fact that there was other evidence supporting Snowell's testimony and corroborating, is there an element of harmlessness here?
If the court wishes to articulate it in terms of harmlessness, I would say yes. I think what's important is the test is whether the evidence that was admissible at the joint trial would have been inadmissible at the severed trial. Not unavailable, not different, but inadmissible. Nothing that was testified to at the joint trial here by Murphy or anyone else would have been inadmissible against Green. So the test is really whether that evidence would have been inadmissible or whether exculpatory evidence that would have been admissible was inadmissible. None of that is here. Green has identified no such evidence that would satisfy that test. I think, Your Honors, it is informative to look at Blunt. I think that we should look at the Blunt and Hall case for a great example of what is not present in this case. This court did not reverse and mandate separate trials in Blunt and Hall because of a coercion or a duress defense. It did so because there was a specific trial right that was compromised by the joint trial. Those trial rights involved the spousal privilege and the fact that evidence that was more prejudicial than probative came in against Hall that would not have been admissible had he been tried separately. The only reason that Blunt was permitted to testify that he roughed her up and chipped her tooth and threatened that they would be killed if she didn't make that fraudulent phone call was because it was relevant to her defense. That was easily Rule 403, more prejudicial than probative evidence that would not have come in against Hall in a separate trial. They both could have taken advantage of a spousal privilege to keep certain evidence out. Hall's trial and conviction was overturned and mandated to be separate because there was a specific trial right that was compromised by the joint trial. That does not exist here. It had nothing to do with just because it was a duress defense or coercion defense. The reason that Hall was reversed was because evidence came in that would have been inadmissible in a separate trial that helped to convict him.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that Murphy's testimony is substantively different as far as a jury's consideration. And I'm not talking about the actual content, but when Murphy is on trial and testifying and essentially corroborating Snowell and inculpating Green, he's essentially making a statement against interest in acknowledging that there was a kidnapping. And that is in real time known to the jury that it's a statement against interest. If, for instance, he were to testify against Green in a separate trial, it really wouldn't be a statement against interest. And that is, under the hearsay rules, an additional basis for credibility. If he were, you know, under an immunity agreement or had, as with Wong, already been acquitted, it's really not against his interest. And that seems to be qualitatively different than his testimony against Green in a joint trial.
It may be, Your Honor, but I think that goes to whether Green is more or less likely to be convicted in the second trial. And that's not the injury that a reversal here would seek to address. Under the precedents, the likelihood of conviction is simply not the improper prejudice that this court would seek to.
What about Murphy's testimony about the ongoing federal investigation into Green and Wong?
So, Your Honor, in the first instance,
that's certainly prejudicial.
In the first instance, and that was stricken from the record, Your Honor, that was not evidence that was admissible at the joint trial, but inadmissible against Green. It was inadmissible at both trials, and the judge properly instructed the jury to disregard that. He even tailored the closing charge in a way that matched what Green's attorney asked him to do in order to remind them to disregard that improper testimony.
One other point, Judge Chigueras may have answered this, but at a point, the government told the jury that obviously both defendants' theories cannot be true. That sounds like mutual antagonism to me.
Your Honor, that was an argument that the government made because the argument, the government believed and wanted the jury to find that both men were guilty. And as the court instructed the jury,
well, how do you get the benefit of that argument on both sides? You tried to win a trial and now you come back to say it wasn't mutually antagonistic.
Green's trial counsel did no different. Green's trial counsel acknowledged that Murphy testified that Green pointed a gun at Snowell and then argued in closing that maybe it was Murphy that pointed the gun at Snowell. We don't know. The defenses were not, I was kidnapped too, and there was no kidnapping. The argument was, I did not have the intent to kidnap anyone because I was coerced, and you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that I did these acts and I did them intentionally.
But don't the words, both theories cannot be true, tell the jury, choose one?
Your Honor, the government's argument is not dispositive, because the government could have been wrong in that argument. And this court could find that the jury could have found that both Murphy lacked the intent and the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of kidnapping. The defenses are no different than they were in the Voight case. All of the co-defendants said, yes, this happened because Voight deceived us and we did what he wanted us to do. And Voight said, I didn't do it. This is really no different than the Voight case. And I understand that it's a conspiracy, but it's still a joint criminal venture.
I know you're right.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll hear rebuttal.
Just two brief things, unless the court wants me to go anywhere else. The first one is that, Judge Fisher, I believe that your memory is correct, that I think the government may have conflated two different other crimes evidences that came in at the Green Murphy joint trial. At appendix page 269, the ongoing investigation of Wong and Green does come in as evidence. There's no curative instruction at that point. And that's part of Murphy's testimony, self-serving testimony in the trial, that I'm the good guy in the situation. The ATF were actually after Wong and Green for other crimes that they committed. That was not cured by any kind of curative instruction. And the second point that I just want to close the loop on is that, just Judge Chung, you did mention that a harmlessness analysis may, or are wondering how does that fold into any of this. I do think that the test this court has articulated, the two-part test, abuse of discretion at the time that the motion was made, viewing the record, and then what trial developments are reasonably foreseeable. The second part of the test is the defendant must pinpoint clear and substantial prejudice resulting in a manifestly unfair trial. I think that prejudice test is, I think that a harmless error analysis would be subsumed by that prejudice test, that prejudice test and harmless error are probably the same thing. And that if you conclude that Mr. Green has met part one and part two of the test, I think harmless error also falls away in Green's favor.
Unless, so it's your position that to establish prejudice, mutually antagonistic defenses is sufficient. We don't also look to whether it's harmless.
That's
given
correct.
All of the evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that if you've already established that he met the two parts of the test that we lay out on the first page of our argument in the appellate brief. If he's met those two parts, I think harmlessness, it plays no role in the analysis. The prejudice test for severance is just as onerous as the harmlessness test.
And the only reason I asked is to Judge Chigueras' point, it's not a very fulsome area of law for us, and the Seventh Circuit has suggested that you still go on to consider the weight of the evidence.
I understand, and I respectfully would disagree with that if the court found that there was an abuse of discretion and that it was prejudicial, that the defendant has pinpointed clear and substantial prejudice. And I mean, a perfect barometer of that is, what does a severed out trial look like? Wong's separate trial, the evidence comes in differently. Wong even says Snowell had his gun back during the kidnapping. I think that that's a good barometer on what prejudice would look like. And I think that the prejudice test on the severance issue is either coterminous with harmlessness, or if it's been established, then harmlessness is passing the harmless error test is also established too.
I'm concerned with the implications of a decision that favored your client here as to what it would mean in subsequent joint trials.
I understand the parade of horribles.
And so if you had a pen, how would you shape an opinion that was narrow enough not to impact cases? And I know you're both familiar with the Williams case that we decided about 5 years ago, like 12 co-defendants, 2 month trial.
Lengthy opinion.
Whole host of issues.
Right.
I mean, how would you shape an opinion that wouldn't impact every multiple defendant case on the government's docket across the circuit?
I think that there are two limiting principles. Judge Fisher, you already identified one, is that this was not a conspiracy charge. It was a discrete incident of kidnapping. And then I think the second limiting principle, I'll slow down, I apologize. The second limiting principle would be that there was a factual proffer in Blunt and Hall, and there's a factual proffer here that my client wants to testify, affirmative evidence will come in, and that should be a limiting principle on granting or denying these severance motions. Not just hypothesizing what the evidence will look like, but an actual proffer that a co-defendant will testify, and this is what the testimony will be. I apologize. I see my time is
up. Sorry, we asked you questions. Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank counsel for their excellent briefing and argument today in this interesting case. We will take the case under advisement.